And welcome back to the Over the Fence show here on Raglan Community Radio and Free FM in the studio with our guest today, Crystal Van Hoot or Hout?
From Houter.
Van Houter. There we are. From the Karioi Project. Welcome. Thanks for coming in, Crystal.
Thank you.
And I guess firstly, tell us a bit about yourself. Regular listeners to the morning show would have heard you on a show many times talking about the Karioi Project and things, but maybe not the Free FM listeners and some of these shows, as I say.
Done a few sessions with Aaron, so it's been good. So I've been in Raglan for, I don't know, over 20 years. But before that, was born and bred in the Netherlands. My mum's Flemish, came to New Zealand when I was 11 and lived in South Auckland. And then I decided to study agriculture and turned up at Massey University. Everyone was wondering what a girl who lived in South Auckland was doing at Massey University studying agriculture. But I was really into animals and mammals, so I thought it was my gig. And ended up as a shear milker for 5 years around the Waikato. And then I usually joke and say I saw the light, but gosh, can I say that today?
Well, maybe not today.
No, so I ended up going back to university and studying, doing science. So I did marine and freshwater ecology.
What made you do that one from agriculture? I suppose different kinds of animals, I suppose.
Yeah. I'd kind of had, you know, like every pet under the sun, you know, engaged with animals, loved animals, did the farming thing, didn't like the early mornings that much, milking cows, loved the calves. I was AB technician. So just did lots of that stuff. But then just always had this real desire to go back. And I think the thing about caring for the earth, kind of, and just looking after the environment, like, and I think I'd seen some shows, like some crazy shows, like of like sharks and just about dock rangers and what kind of work they did. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, you know, like, so I'd done a bit, also dabbled in a bit of vet nursing.
All right.
And so I think I was just like, I hadn't finished my ag degree, and so I was like, I want to go back and finish it. And then I think once I was there back at uni, I was like, I just realised my interest had kind of changed. And actually, in the time I was a farmer, like, I guess there were still some practices that probably weren't, you know, they're not as acceptable nowadays. Like, it was pretty hardcore. And also, the one thing that really struck me was that all the farmers were chopping down their trees. And that used to really annoy me.
Yes.
You know, and you'd like sometimes have some cows with eczema and they'd be running to the shed, and like it didn't feel like I was taking care of the animals the way I wanted to.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess it shifted my focus on a more caring kind of nurturing type role, you know, environmentally rather than just farming animals.
Yeah.
And so I ended up, you know, studying marine and freshwater ecology because I really enjoyed being in the water as well.
Mm-hmm.
And did my master's there as well, and then spent a bit of time overseas, and then came back to Raglan.
Okay. I see you on your biology, on your magnificent website, if you haven't checked it out yet, karioiproject.org,
yeah.
I presume,
yeah.
That you spent a bit of time in Samoa and Kenya doing environmental kind of, what did you do,
yeah.
Interesting places?
Yeah. So, I mean, yeah, rather than doing the, you know, standard OE to the UK where it's cold and miserable, I decided I didn't need to go back to Europe. I'd already lived there. So had opportunity to go to Samoa. It ended up in American Samoa. And I got a job there as a kind of working in water quality.
Mm-hmm.
So mainly fresh water. And just basically we did lots of research and like kind of inventory around water quality and in the streams, and did big biological inventories of what animals lived there. And so I had a really great time, taught a little bit of marine ecology as well, tropical marine ecology, and then, did quite a bit of travel while there. And then I had found out about this organisation called Arosha, which is the, you know, I've run Arosha here in New Zealand now.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were, you know, looked on their map and they were present all, you know, had different national entities around the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd always wanted to go to Africa and see all the animals, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And so contacted them, and I'd actually hit on their website and they said, we're looking for a marine ecologist. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is amazing. This is, you know, my thing. And so, yeah, went over there and spent 3 months with them. And just did a small project, but I think the biggest impact was just seeing how they combined caring for the poor with looking after the environment and, you know, try to find ways of alleviating poverty, but also, you know, supporting communities, but also restoring their natural environment, you know, where the communities lived. And I felt that was really powerful, you know, looking after people as well as the land. And that became a real inspiration for me, like coming back here and kind of, you know, you can't disconnect the two. People are part of nature, part of, you know, and part of the solution, part of the problem. So it all really resonated with me, and it kind of came back feeling really inspired to kind of come back and do something like that here. Obviously, I had to get a job, so I worked for NIWA for 5 years in Hamilton.
Yeah.
And while I was working there, with a bunch of people here in this community, set up the Karioi project.
All right. And so setting it up, what, I guess, your experiences in Kenya would have sort of led you in that direction, I guess, of the people in the land. And was there much of an appetite for it when you first started thinking about it, or were people already talking about it? Or
yeah, kind of, it was two things happened. Like, I was driving across the Divi from Hamilton to Raglan every day, you know, for work. And I remember looking at the mountain going, there's no community project on this mountain. Like, you know, and it kind of felt like it was kind of like, you know, kind of talking to me, you know, like calling out. It's like, you know, these thoughts come into your head and you kind of wonder where they come from.
Yeah.
And I had been involved with a small project at Kakapuka out Te Aumuru way.
Right.
With a North Island robin transfer. So I had a little bit of experience with kind of terrestrial ecology and bird stuff. And then the guy I worked with in Kenya was a really fanatical birder. So I'd kind of worked a little bit with birds and kind of gone, oh, they're kind of cool, but they're not mammals. But, you know, yeah. In New Zealand, you either look like birds or you kill mammals, right? So so it was kind of like, oh, well, you know, maybe if I'm going to be in New Zealand doing conservation, you know, you've got to like birds. Mm. And then at the time, Malibu Hamilton, who was based here, and he had been part of Te Whaka o Waranga o Karioi, which, you know, was to restore Karioi, and that was part of, you know, in the combination with some of the anti-1080 feelings that people had in this community.
Yeah.
And so he hit me up and said, hey, do you want to start something here? You know, like, can you go and talk to Doc and tell them, like, we want to start a community project here? So we used to catch up with him, and then also the late Sandy Hunuku and John Lawson, a few different people, you know, that were kind of like badgering me a little bit and saying, hey, you know, you're back in town.
Nudging you in the direction.
Yeah. And I was kind of like, oh, well, you know, I'm a marine ecologist and, do I want to be doing predator control? I don't even know how to set a trap. But anyway, they convinced me. And then I thought, well, if I'm not working, you know, in the water or doing marine stuff, at least I'm working on a mountain right next to the sea.
Yes.
So is this process of convincing myself that that was a good thing, and then eventually wrote a little proposal to Doc, and they supported it.
Great.
So we started at Upper Wainui Reserve on, the 10 hectares, and chucked a whole bunch of traps in there. We got a really great support from Ollie Gansel, who's a local but also working for Doc. And he showed us how to set the traps and what to do, and, you know, helped us with some of the technical support we needed. Got a small grant from Doc to pay for the equipment. And then we had, like, I don't know, a dozen volunteers that, you know, half of them were actually ecologists that I knew that lived in this community, and the other half was, like, just local people living, you know, around Wainui Reserve. And we all just went out and set the traps. Caught about 80 rats in the first week, I think.
Far out.
And then we were like, oh, this is pretty cool. It's, you know, it's a big job.
Yeah.
But we kind of felt like we made a difference just by doing the trapping over springtime. We'd give the birds a chance to breed. And so we were just going to do it for spring. And then after spring, you know, going to summer, all the volunteers were just like, no, we'll keep doing this. This is cool, you know, we'll keep trapping. And we've never stopped.
So was that along that track you can walk to now up along Upper Wainui? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, so we just access it from the side, you know, from Upper Wainui Road, that little side entry.
Yeah, yeah.
And then cross the stream, and then we just set the trap lines right through the forest there.
Right.
Yeah, so there's like about 5 trap lines in there.
Gee whiz, all right.
So the traps are only like 50 metres by 25 metres apart or something. Like, they're really close together in there.
Okay.
And, you know, that area has just really benefited from not just that little bit, but all the other work that's obviously gone on around that since then.
How far do rats kind of go in there, a little bit of turf?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. Like, you know, the whole thing about a trapping network is you have to set it up for the ecology of the species. So rats don't travel very far. So it's like they reckon their home range is about 50 to 100 metres. Huh. So you have to have a trap in within each rat's home range. And then as rats breed, all those little rats, like, then disperse into new areas. Right. So you're constantly managing not only the rats that are there, so you knock them down, but then you're also managing dispersal and reinvasion.
Right, okay.
So you're constantly trapping, but what we found is that you knock off that whole big population, you'll get a few trap-shy animals that'll, you know, maybe avoid your traps and never get into them, or they'll keep breeding. And then you kind of bring it down to probably about 10 to 20% activity rate, we call it, like where you can monitor and kind of see how many are still left.
Okay. Yeah.
And so, and then you're kind of managing that reinvasion. Mm-hmm. So like out of every 10 to 15 traps that are out there, you might get two or three rats. Okay. You know, whereas at the start you get like 80% or something.
All right.
You know, so you really knock it down, but then, yeah, sometimes you've got to change methods, change bait, change traps, maybe use a little bit of bait, you know, as well, like toxins, because it can knock down those ones that don't end up in your traps.
Mm-hmm.
So we always kind of joke how you have to use, you know, all the tools in your toolbox, you know, to get everything.
Mm.
Yeah.
When was the last time 1080 was dropped on Karioi?
So they had a 1080 drop, I think it was about 4 years ago.
Okay, right.
Can't remember the exact date in my head, but yeah, it was about 4 years ago.
All right.
So what they do now is that they just flew basically mostly the back of the mountain.
Right.
All the Hapu block and a big block, what we call the Wainui block, so above Wainui Road, all that gets hand laid.
Right.
In bait stations.
Okay.
So docks help cut tracks there. And the Hapu puts, you know, has bait stations that they fill. And then all around the edges of the mountain and on private land, also regional council as part of that will come in and fill a whole bunch of bait stations or do trapping as well on private land.
Mm-hmm.
And so kind of everything gets a real good knock and, you know, gets knocked down.
Mm.
But it all comes back really quickly if you don't cover everything.
Mm-hmm.
So the work we're doing is really supporting, you know, some of that work that's happening, but also we're doing, you know, more and more every year. So we've added more traps, more networks, you know, over the last 10 years. So we've got thousands of traps now, hundreds of, you know, kilometres of trap lines, and we're also setting up a bait station grid right on the eastern side of the mountain, which is like, there's about a total of 700 hectares there now.
Right.
So we can do bait station work. And that's to get all the little birds kind of a chance to breed.
All right.
Because we target both possums and rats.
Yep.
And especially the rats and that, like, you know, have a big impact on the breeding of small birds.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Just off my deck the other day, I was sitting out on the deck. It was a stoat or a ferret, a white sort of belly and neck and brown on the back. Is that a stoat or a ferret?
Yeah, was it quite thin?
Yeah, pretty thin and kind of long.
Yeah, so that's probably a stoat.
All right.
The ferrets are a bit more fatter, bigger bodied.
Right.
In saying that, you don't see them very often.
Yeah.
But they're definitely a problem. So, like, ferrets and stoats and that travel long distances, so they can go kilometres overnight. So
right.
The reason why we have to have such a massive network of traps, so, like, most of our stoat traps are about, the lines are about a kilometre apart, and then every trap's 100 metres.
Okay.
Up the line, and then we try and target roadsides and streams and areas where they're most likely to travel. And so they're much smarter and much kind of...
How do I catch the stoat?
More likely to avoid traps, you know? So you have to really lure them in. And so you have to have this network so that the chance of them encountering a trap is really high.
Right.
And that's how we control them
or okay.
try and manage them anyway. But we're still getting incursions, you know, on our seabird... sites,
yeah.
breeding sites where we're getting, you know, random ferrets or stoats coming in and they'll just nail burrow after burrow after burrow and stash the chicks or whatever they catch.
Right.
Yeah, okay. So they're pretty gnarly. They're real killing machines.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Killy creatures.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And wasn't it used like a chopped up rabbit or something as your bait? Is that right?
Yeah, we've done a bit of fresh bait, and we go and get shoot rabbits and get farmers to contribute, you know, frozen rabbits to us that we chop up, and we do these things called rabbit drags, where you basically get a gooey, bleeding, horrible rabbit. Well, not horrible rabbit, it's a very cute rabbit, but it's horrible when it's dead. Sounds really gruesome, but we're talking to farmers, right?
So,
So we drag them around so that it creates these scent trails.
Right.
And then the animal picks it up and follows it, and it becomes an appealing kind of thing to get them into traps.
Ah.
Or cages or whatever we're using.
So
there's a bit of a science behind it. There's experts on this stuff.
Yeah, all right.
People that do this every day. So we try and learn from the experts. We've had experts come in and teach us a whole bunch of stuff. Seabird experts and predator control experts. And we try and learn as much as we can from them. And then we try and apply those methods here.
Really, that'd be really interesting. You must learn a lot of stuff.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, too much sometimes.
Yeah. And how's the farmer kind of and landowner kind of relationship with you guys been?
Oh, it's been great, yeah. So right from the start, we kind of visited with Thomas Lord, actually, who lives on the mountain, and he was doing a lot of the track cutting for us. Him and I went and visited actually pretty much every farmer around the mountain in the early days of the project.
Mm-hmm.
And he already knew everyone, so basically introduced me and, you know, just had nice chats with all these farmers, and they were really supportive because we rely on these landowners for access because otherwise you couldn't get up the mountain the way we do.
Mm.
And, they've been super supportive, you know, giving access, providing, you know, rides up the, you know, to the forest line so we don't have to walk as much and... just all sorts of ways that, you know, they it's been really, really lovely. Some of them help fund things. We have amazing landowner support.
Mm.
And I mean, obviously not just farmers. It's also all the people living around the coastline.
Yep.
We've got heaps of traps at Whale Bay through our backyard hub.
Right.
Where just local residents are trapping in their own backyard.
Mm.
And then we've also got other farmers that might have bush blocks and, you know, like... native bush on their farm, and they want to do the predator control, and so they've engaged us. So we have what we call a social enterprise service.
Mm-hmm.
So people pay us to do the the trapping or the bait stations, whatever they want, and then they pay us, and then any profits we make, you know, obviously pays our team, but if we do make any profits, it goes back into the project. So that's a really great way, you know, like not only do they improve biodiversity on their own farm, and we get a bit of a kickback on it as well. So,
it's a similar thing for your backyard hub, isn't it? People around town and that, isn't it? You can go on to, well, they kind of pay you to come and trap, or they can if they want, pay, you know, trap the rats on their properties and that kind of thing.
Is
it a similar kind of model? Or?
Yeah. So what happened, like for the back, even when the backyard, before it even started, backyard hub, like people would ring regional council and say, hey, I've got possums in my backyard, they're eating all my fruit trees or whatever was going on. And then regional council would say, oh, well, contact the Cutio Project, which is pretty much at the time me, you know, me and volunteers, but I was the only paid person. And then they'd be dropping off traps and going, okay, this is not an efficient model.
Yeah.
So we started the backyard hub where we would train up neighbourhoods or, you know, group of friends or someone that wanted to trap.
Mm.
And we call them trap-aware parties, not Tupperware, trap-aware parties.
Very nice.
Yeah. we started like a whole bunch of people on Hills Road and a whole bunch of people on Cambrai Road, you know, like, so we just started slowly just teaching people how to trap, putting traps in their own backyard, just putting more and more traps in everywhere. And that kind of acts as a buffer for everything, you know, that's coming up and down the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
So the more traps we get out in the community, the better it is for us and for biodiversity.
For sure. Yeah.
So that's kind of how it all started. And then, of course, we got some people that are like, I want traps. I don't want toxins, but I want traps, but I don't want to check them myself because I don't want to deal with the dead animal.
Mm-hmm.
Or sometimes people were ringing up saying, we're getting complaints from our Booker Patch people because there's rats running through the place.
Right.
And you might notice at this time of year, like there's lots of mice and rats trying to get into places, into garages, into pantries. And so often at this time of year, people start calling us up and saying, help, I need a trap. Okay. So we were just like, oh, well, if people want us to do it, we've got these awesome school leavers that we run a education program at the school called Manakiao.
Right.
So we've taught a whole bunch of kids how to trap, and some of them want jobs. So we can kind of employ school leavers to help check these traps. So we've kind of been trialling that for, you know, over a year.
It's another great flow-on initiative from what you're doing, isn't it?
Pardon?
Providing employment. It's another great flow-on initiative, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Yeah. So, yeah, because you see all these young people and they're super passionate. And, you know, some of them just love this kind of work. And it's outdoors and outside, you know, doing stuff. So we've got three guys from the Manakiao program that we're employing.
Cool.
Both in trap cutting and trapping and also doing education stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And they're awesome. Yeah, so we're really proud of them and, like, really stoked that we can – it's definitely been that goal around doing the, you know, conservation, education and providing local employment.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got 12 people on team now, paid.
Cool.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And with the dead rats, I was just a thought sort of out of the blue came into my head. Could you make them into, like, a fertilizer or something?
Well, possibly, yeah, if someone's keen to churn them up. There's definitely, like, you know, just possum trappers. Like, obviously, we've done a bit of fur stuff as well, you know, like when we catch, you know, possums, we'll get the fur.
How's the market for possum fur these days?
I don't know what the latest, I think it used to be about $120.
Yeah, it was heaps for a couple of years back, wasn't it?
Yeah, but I'm not too sure what it is actually at the moment. But, but yeah, like, there are trappers and hunters out there that do supply for pet food, mm-hmm. but mainly possums.
Yeah, possum, yeah, yeah.
By the time we get to the rats, they're usually not in an edible state anymore.
Generally pretty maggoty. Pretty maggoty.
Yeah, they go off pretty quick.
Yeah, true. Yeah, okay, well,
yeah.
Maybe that won't be my $1 million idea, no. Making rats into fertilizer.
You can try it, though. You can feed back to me. Happy to take your instructions.
Yeah, okay. All right. So that's the Carryall project, and that's and you've had partners, obviously. So the council and that, you know, obviously they're referring people onto you. And are they involved or supporting you guys much at all? Or?
Yeah, yeah. People do ask that. And I think it's actually one of the nice stories I get to tell is that the council has been really supportive and Doc. And I think in the Waikato, just, you know, compared to some regions where I've talked to people, you know, they've tried to do the same thing. They haven't received the same support.
Mm.
So I think we're really lucky. We've got a natural heritage fund with Regional Council.
Right.
That funds community projects. And then DOCS usually had a, you know, community fund as well.
Mm-hmm.
And they provide lots of technical support, and that, especially in the early days. But Regional Council funds us from the natural heritage fund. It's a four-year fund of about $100K a year.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of provides a bit of a baseline for us to pay a lot of expenses,
mm-hmm.
and some staff time as well. Yep. And that's been amazing. That's just completely changed things for us. Like, obviously we were all volunteers at the start for like over 5 years,
mm-hmm.
but eventually as you grow you need to pay people.
Mm.
You know, so we've had amazing volunteers, you know, might do a couple of hours a week or every 2 weeks, and then you get the real stars that will do a day a week or something, you know, because they can.
Mm.
But then if you want any more time than that, most of the time people need to be paid. You've all got bills. And so, it's been a privilege to be able to employ people in our community that are super passionate about the work they do. They always put in more than you pay them for, you know, and it's a real lifestyle job.
Yeah,
and they do a great job. Mm, yeah,
And you've just set up a Give a Little page as well, I understand.
Yes, yeah, that's been a little bit of a challenge. It's awesome. So very first time we've done Give a Little. We've already had people in this community donating to the project quite regularly, quite significant amounts. Really amazing. Again, helps cover so many of our costs, you know, that you might not be able to get a grant for, especially.
It costs for everything. You've got to make the traps, you know, buy the staff, pay your staff and everything.
Staff and, traps and
transport.
All adds up, you know. Mm-hmm. Like, so, you know, I think we still do really well. Like, we run on a pretty, you know, slim budget. A couple of hundred K a year gets us a long way.
Mm-hmm.
Very small overheads. So I think in that way, you know, we get bang for our buck. But the Give a Little was just like, we've just had a bit of a funding pinch. Like we used to, you know, probably have about a 90% success rate with funding grants and all that kind of thing. And last year it got really hard just with COVID. We weren't able to get the Jobs for Nature funding. We weren't the only ones. Just there was, you know, it sounds like there's lots of money out there and then you apply and then there's only so much per region. So we were pretty gutted about that. So we were like, okay, what else can we do? So we've got a social enterprise. We can, you know, we've looked for some other funds. We've got some other people on board to help support us. And then we were like, oh, let's do a Give a Little. There's so many amazing volunteers in this community and so many people that often comment or businesses that come along and funded or supported us. And so we thought, oh, well, we'll give it a go. But, it definitely makes you feel a bit vulnerable when you're asking for money from your own community and from the people you're connected with. And lots of our family and friends, you know, donated, which is really lovely.
So we
kind of got it going. And then we've had some amazing match funders. And then suddenly it just went crazy last week with the match funders. And we got some really good donations come through. So we were aiming for 20,000. And I think we're sitting around 14 now, 14,000.
Close.
And we've got a few days to go.
Right.
So I think we might be close to 15 even. So we've got about 5,000 to go. So can I just say, like, you know, if you have not donated yet on our Give a Little page, you can find us on Facebook and or Give a Little website. It's called For the Bird Song.
For the Bird Song.
And if you would like to make a donation, we would love your support. And also we're inviting people to just become regular donors. Like, you know, you can donate on the Give a Little, you know, as much as you want, of course. But if you want to continue supporting the project, it gives us an opportunity to plan ahead. You know, if we've got people donating, say, monthly or annually, we're able to kind of plan to do more work the more support we have. So every dollar makes a difference.
I suppose you can just spread the net wider and wider, the more you go.
Like, so we're doing lots of intensification, you know, and... And the nice thing is that for those people that really dislike 1080, and I know a lot of people in this community do, and that's, you know, that's okay. So what's probably not going to happen again is that they're not going to fly 1080, and docs, you know, putting money into, you know, track cutting, putting more traps and tracks out there, so that we can do ground control. So I think for people that don't want to see, you know, toxins aerially applied, that's a real win, and that's something that, you know, has happened because this community has worked really hard to make that happen. So I think it's pretty cool.
I guess to me, it's best that, I mean, it's a vexed one, the old 1080 thing, right? But yeah, I know it's kind of, doc don't even really like using themselves, but it's the only choice they've got, right? But a project like the Cutty Oil project can, of course, you know, keep 1080 well away from the community if you guys keep going.
And I mean, it's like, and it's expanding. Easy not to talk about it, but actually, you know, 1080 is a big thing in conservation, right? It comes up all the time. And I think, you know, it is another tool in the toolbox. You know, but there are alternatives. And if a community wants it and people are willing to volunteer and we're willing to fund community-based conservation, you can have a different outcome. And that's cool. And so we've you know, been part of that solution and we're willing to keep working on that. I'm not saying that 1080 will never be used, like, you know, more than likely, you know, it could be. And it is a cheap toxin. And you know, and if there's, you know, as research, you know, with predator-free 2050, if research, you know, and things, you know, new methods get developed and we'll definitely be keen to use them. Maybe we can eliminate using toxins altogether. That would be a real win for everyone.
For sure, yeah.
Yeah.
Is the predator-free 2050 thing, is that just kind of all talk or is there actually a bit of money come out of that or what?
It's definitely going towards the bigger landscape scale projects.
I thought yours would be pretty big, wouldn't it?
Yeah, Kariwai is a couple of, you know, thousand, and then at a landscape scale, kind of Kariwai to Porongia. Which is kind of the landscape we're working on surrounding Kariwai. So there's like 20,000.
But
they tend to, you know, there's a lot of focus on some of the big tracks in South Island. And, it hasn't been as easy to tap into that funding as we thought it would be. They've tended to say we're too small. unfortunately.
Oh, yeah.
And and so, yeah, that's been a challenge. But in saying that, when we used to apply for funding before the whole predator-free 2050, predator control was just really not sexy.
Yeah.
And it was just like, you know, you'd ask for traps and no one wanted to fund traps. It was just considered boring or something. I don't know.
Right.
As soon as predator-free 2050 was announced, I had like the Waikato Times wanting to talk to us.
Right.
And everyone, suddenly it was like the new next best thing.
Right,
and
okay.
Everyone was into it. And the funding has become more available and more acceptable to apply for funding for that kind of work.
All right.
So that's really nice. Yeah.
Yeah,
so
that's really nice.
There's
yeah.
something about creating a vision that we can all buy into.
Yeah.
And all these predator-free communities all around the country, you know, like what they've done in Wellington and, all, you know, lots of little community cities and all sorts, is amazing. And that's, I think that's because there's this shared vision. And so, you know, it was a stage approach where, you know, we aimed for predator-free islands, offshore islands. And then we got predator-free mainland islands like Mangatauri.
Yep.
And now we're kind of saying, well, actually, can we create these predator-free islands without the fence? You know, and that's basically what we're kind of testing.
Yeah.
It's like, how much can we do? What does it take to eliminate predators from Karioi and surrounds?
Well, especially, I guess, with Karioi, it's like it's a Porongia Ecological Group who've been... You were just saying before they were established a couple of years before you guys, you're in touch with them.
Mm.
And we just had Bexy on, of course, on the show here a few weeks ago, if you remember, listeners. And she was, of course, started off the Karioi project. And she's going right from Mangatauri through to Porongia. And from there to Karioi is not too much of a leap, is it?
Yeah. So, yeah, when they kind of initiated that project, the kind of Mangatauri to Porongia Ecological Corridor, I kind of caught up with Claire, who runs the Porongia, you know, Ecological Society project.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, if you've got, you know, a corridor between Porongia and Mangatauri, we should have one between Porongia and Karioi as well.
For sure.
And so we've been kind of chatting with Mā Tokotoko Marae, like Heather Thompson and that, and they're really keen to see Tauruparu wetland restored. And
it's an amazing wetland, isn't it?
Yeah. And I mean, heaps of people don't even know about it, you know. And so, and then we've got Bridalveil Falls and we've got Karioi and Porongia. So it just kind of seems like if we just planted up and restored the stream, kind of that network between the two mountains and those habitats, it's actually only about 23 kilometres.
Mm-hmm.
We can get those farmers on board and do some of that work. We could have a real natural corridor between the two mountains, which would allow, you know, birds to fly between the two mountains and translocate themselves naturally.
Yeah. Is there a bit of energy from the farmers out there in that direction, do you know? Or?
There's quite a lot of support around the wetland.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it just takes time and funding. What's happening a lot now is, you know, various individual farmers are getting support from council to do more fencing.
Yep.
And just fencing off streams and waterways and putting trees in the ground. And that's an awesome thing to be able to do right now. It's such a simple model, but so effective. And then, you know, once the trees are in the ground, it's good to obviously do the predator control so that any birds that come through or, you know, live there, they, you know, their kind of nesting sites are protected.
Yeah.
So it's not so complicated, really. It just takes time to get it all done.
Yeah, and I know on Fonterra Farms, it's compulsory now to repair and plant your streams and wetlands and things. And I think there's some legislation going through where it's going to be compulsory for all farmers, or, you know, sheep, beef, and all that as well.
Yeah.
In a few years. So, yeah, it's but if you get the council funding now while it's there to do it, you know, it saves you having to do it all off your own bat, you know, when you have to, I guess.
Yeah. Like, there's been funding available for a long time. But I know farmers who the work they do on the fencing or whatever they do is considered in-kind contribution.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get a third or two thirds from council. And so the actual cash cost doesn't have to be that high. You know, this community has been so lucky having Harbour Care, who have planted up all the harbour and nearly pretty much every stream that runs into the harbour at such minimal cost, often funded themselves. So we are so lucky here for what we have. You know, most of the native trees and the planting you see, it's been done by Harbour Care, and it looks amazing. And so I'm sure we can push that further out. You know, there's some amazing landowners just revegetating whole, you know, hectares and hectares of land. And so places is going to look amazing in 10, 20 years' time. There's, yeah, just a real opportunity to revegetate a lot of kind of unproductive land.
It's really interesting, that one. You said, like, at the start, you watched all the farmers chopping down trees and that. And, yeah, I remember that too. My grandfather, of course, chopping down trees, and then sort of Dad, you know, clearing the scrub and that. But now he's even planting trees himself, and certainly the next generation down and below, I think, are just going to plant more. So I think there's going to be more of them that just naturally as time goes by, I think.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any blame in it. Like, I think at that time, people were busy clearing the land to make it productive. And now we kind of realise, oops, maybe we went a little bit too far. Put a little bit back, you know. And it's pretty obvious when you look at, you know, how highly eroded some land is. It doesn't actually make sense to farm it. You know, it probably, like, a lot of the work that's been done, you know, the farm, you know, that big farm, on the Divi?
Yes.
The research farm?
Yep.
I don't even know what it's called nowadays. But
No, nor do I, actually.
Yeah, but we did a whole bunch of work there, and some of it was done while I was at NIWA. And heaps of the research showed that, you know, when you planted up streams and fenced them off, you know, your animal health improved, you know, your stock loss, you know, decreased, you know, so you're not getting your animals bogged down. And
surprise, surprise.
And land was more productive, you know, so because you're using your most productive land to graze, grow grass. You know, so all that research was done and kind of showed that, you know, doing all those really good environmental initiatives were, you know, resulted in a better farm. And better farming practices, healthier animals, and also the farm probably looks a heck of a lot better too. And so, you know, it is a massive job. Like, I'm not underestimating that, especially when you start getting into hill country, right?
For sure.
But yeah. I think it's exciting if New Zealand can keep pushing that way, because we need to do it. Need to do it for climate. We need to do it for biodiversity. And I just want to really encourage farmers. Like, you know, there's lots of groups that are, you know, or neighbours that were, you know, nearby, you know, villages or whatever that might be keen to come and help you plant. You know, so it doesn't have to be something you have to do all by yourself. You know, there is opportunity to work in with a land care group or, you know, a local environment centre or whoever, and say, hey, can you bring a bunch of volunteers and help me plant trees? And if it's on a bigger scale, you know, maybe you need to employ some other people. But, you know, there are lots of creative ways that people are doing this stuff.
Yeah.
And there's lots of expertise in that area. And so I think, yeah, I think if you can kind of connect in and, you know, with those people willing to support you, like, I think it can be a really positive thing for your farm and just everything we're doing for, you know, and for the environment in general.
For sure. You want to get a hold of the Karioi Project and talk about these things, what to plant and how to plant and trapping on your land or whatever, I mean, what's the easiest way?
Yeah, if you can, you can go to our Facebook page or Instagram or website. All just karioiproject.co.nz, and there's, you know, a button you can push for messages or contact us or donate or whatever you want to do. And yeah, we'll be there.
All right.
You'll get a reply.
I don't even know how long we've been talking for, but I suppose we get to start wrapping it up. So give a little page. So that's closes
on Friday.
Okay. So by the time you guys, oh, I won't say that, I'll spoil the surprise. This is actually live. No, it's, So 2 days, a couple of days, folks, from Wednesday. Get in there and help out this magnificent Karioi Project. Yes.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank you so much.
Is there anything else you want to say while you're on?
We've said a lot.
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah.
Certainly didn't go the way I was thinking, but I think it was good.
We probably didn't talk as much about the seabirds, but people can go online and see these amazing seabirds that come into the coastline, and it's kind of been a bit of a – the grey-faced petrel oi have been a bit of a focus for the project.
Yep.
And kind of makes Karioi pretty unique, having seabirds fly in. So, but yeah, I've talked about those lots before. But yeah go on online, and I'd probably do one thing. If you go on our website, we've got a little film that was produced by Patagonia. It's a little 12-minute film. If you just want to get a bit of a visual about what the project's all about and what we've done, go and hit on there and have a look.
Cool. And you've done exceptionally well. Off here, you were telling me this morning you've been chatting away to RNZ this morning and chatting away to Doc after that, and then finally this small little show. So thank you very much for coming on.
Lots of talking really today. I might have to go and put some tape over my nut for the rest of the day or something.
Thanks very much, Kristen. Really appreciate
thank
it.
Thank you. Yes. Bye.